The melting pot theory in Detroit, today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. The city of Detroit was once synonymous with economic collapse, job losses, and population decline. Today, foreign-born workers and entrepreneurs are breathing new life into the Motor City. This man from India came looking for a job. Now he employs 600 people.
Because we brought the best of the best all around the globe, and we put them all together, that is our strength.
Also, the big three German car makers, BMW, Daimler, and VW, are all under investigation. They're suspected of working together to hold back on emissions technology.
They are accused, at the very least, of having done a lot to delay the introduction of strict emissions standards.
Those stories and more today on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. It is Tuesday. It is great to have you with us. Today on the show, we'll be looking at the news of America closing its doors to thousands of refugees as part of a campaign promise from Donald Trump to take a harder line on immigration. That's coming up later on the show. We're going to begin, though, with another way that the Trump administration is mixing it up with other countries. The United States and China have taken another step toward an all-out trade war. The Trump administration is imposing new tariffs on Chinese goods entering the U.S. market starting next week. This is the third round of tariffs on China, and it's the biggest yet. 10% tariffs on $200 billion worth of goods from China. At the same time, President Trump's economic advisor, Larry Kudlow, says the administration is still ready to hold trade talks with China if Beijing is willing to meet some demands.
We are ready to negotiate and talk with China anytime that they are ready for serious and substantive negotiations towards free trade, to reduce tariffs and non-tariff barriers, to open markets, to allow the most competitive economy in the world, ours, to export more and more goods and services to China.
But Beijing says it has no choice but to retaliate. Today, China hit back by putting $60 billion worth of tariffs on American goods. That's Foreign Ministry spokesman Gong Shuang. China has to take necessary countermeasures, he says. That should be clear to everyone. Both sides are now threatening to escalate further, and the impact of this trade war is likely to be felt by consumers, including right here in the U.S. One city that certainly knows about economic pain is Detroit, and that's where we go next. 9 years ago, Time magazine ran a cover with a picture of urban American decay. The headline read, "The Tragedy of Detroit, How a Great City Fell and How It Can Rise Again." Today, there are many signs of a comeback, new businesses, stores, and less urban blight. This comeback has been fueled in some part by the arrival of more immigrants. As part of our 50 States project, we've been looking at how globalization impacts communities across the United States. Today, The World's Jason Margolis turns our focus on Michigan and Detroit.
2 years ago, Hamisi Mamba was living in Burundi. He came to Detroit as a refugee and joined his wife and young twin daughters. New country, new culture, new language.
I think that was a big challenge for me because I didn't even take a class. I've been watching cartoons with my girls.
Quickly, he's gone from cartoon watcher to budding restaurant owner. We walk around the hollowed-out guts of his new space.
So this is a dream come true. This is going to be a Baobab Fair, it's African restaurant.
Baobab Fair will serve traditional African juices, coffee, and food.
Baobab is a tree found in West Africa. So why baobab? Because we came here and then the tree grew in the desert and then it's healthy and then it's strong. So we say we are growing in Detroit.
But how does a refugee with no experience running a restaurant get started here? It can be very difficult for immigrants to get access to lines of credit. So you need some help. Mamba got that when he won a $50,000 competition sponsored by the group Hatch Detroit, a contest where residents vote for the type of retail they want in their community. Mamba and his wife organized a pop-up restaurant during the contest.
We sold out over 100 dishes in 30 minutes, and they say, we're going to support you. We're going to vote you.
From there, Mamba got another $50,000 grant from Motor City Match, a private public venture. In Detroit, a lot of private and public organizations, along with banks, are investing in the area's recovery. And like many Rust Belt cities, Detroit is trying to attract immigrants to help fuel that.
Right now, immigrants are the only growing source of population in the city of Detroit. Michigan is the only state that lost population in the 2010 census.
Steve Tabachman runs Global Detroit, a group partly funded by the Detroit Regional Chamber of Commerce. Global Detroit's goal is to help revive derelict neighborhoods by making the city more attractive and welcoming for immigrants. I met Tabachman at an Indian restaurant in Banglatown, a community with a lot of South Asian residents.
They're a source of life and vibrancy, and they are creating jobs that help everyone in the community. They're providing retail services that make this community thrive and providing a tax base and, frankly, occupancy to the vacant structures that are critical to retaining the African-American residents in the region so that this neighborhood doesn't fall away the way that some of the more disinvested ones have.
We took a stroll down the street and met with Rizal Karim, originally from Bangladesh. He runs Everyday Super Discounts. He crams a lot of stuff into this small space.
Everything, almost everything. You can say I sell everything.
Could I buy a razor here?
Many kinds of razor we have.
And what about a watch?
Yeah, we do have watch, several kinds.
Trust me, he's got it all.
Almost everything, yes.
Karim initially moved to Queens, New York, but quickly relocated to Detroit after a friend suggested checking it out.
We'll have a job, and the living cost is less than New York, so we'll be survived easily in here.
Karim isn't just supplying items for the neighborhood. He's creating jobs.
Right now, three employees, excluding me.
Are they all from Bangladesh or no?
Yeah, all from Bangladesh, yes.
The newcomers pay taxes, both personal and property. Entrepreneurs like Karim also generate other economic activity, says Steve Tabachman.
He needs somebody to wash his windows. He needs to hire the truck driver.
The Detroit area has also attracted a lot of high-skilled immigrants. A quarter of Southeast Michigan's practicing physicians and half of the area's engineering PhDs are immigrants. Many are lured here by automotive engineering jobs. And eventually, many job seekers become job creators, like Tel Ganeshan. He's a young-looking 50-year-old, originally from India, a whirlwind of energy with an unforgettable laugh.
Well, I drink a green tea three times a day.
Ganeshan is the founder of Kaiba, an IT staffing firm with 600 employees in the U.S. and 100 in India. He also runs several Kaiba spinoffs.
I'm also a full-feature movie producer.
And he runs a wellness company.
I'm a serial entrepreneur, Jason, but definitely not a serial killer.
Okay. Ganeshan is a fun guy. But when I asked him if he's felt a shift in tone toward immigrants recently, he gets serious. He says he hasn't experienced anything negative himself, but warns that we can't become short-sighted.
We have to first ask the question, what made America the greatest nation on planet Earth? Because we are a melting pot. Because we brought the best of the best all around the globe, and we put them all together, and that is our strength. That will always be America's strength. And if you try to take that recipe away, we will not be as innovative. We will not be as disruptive. Look at all the major companies that are created by the immigrants.
Detroit still has a long way to come back, but civic and business leaders have taken pains to get out the message. If people from across the globe can speed up the city's revival, they're most welcome. For The World, Jason Margolis, Detroit.
Detroit's been through a lot over the years, and it's been a rocky ride for the auto industry there. In Germany, car makers are facing their own problems. First, the focus was on Volkswagen. In 2015, you'll remember, the company was caught cheating. VW had been manipulating emissions testing of its diesel cars in the U.S. by using specially designed software to trick the system. Now the European Union is investigating three German car makers. They're suspected of colluding to hold back on the development of systems that would reduce harmful emissions. BMW, Daimler, and Volkswagen, again, are facing allegations they broke EU antitrust rules by refusing to compete on new technology, denying consumers cleaner cars. Theo Leggett is the BBC's business correspondent. I asked him what the EU is investigating.
Well, the EU knows that a group of car makers called the Circle of Five, which was Daimler, BMW, and then three Volkswagen Group brands, including Audi and Porsche, were meeting regularly to discuss various aspects of their business. Now, that in itself is not illegal. Car makers often collaborate on developing technical standards, research and development, all that kind of thing. And the European Commission has no problem with that, provided it leads to better products for consumers. What they're concerned about in this case, though, is that one of the subjects that those manufacturers discussed was emissions control systems, and it believes that there is a possibility they may have collaborated to delay the introduction of certain types of emission control technologies, so selective catalytic reduction systems for diesel engines and particulate filters for a certain kind of petrol engine.
Are these allegations related at all to the 2015 scandal with VW?
No, they're not. This is a different kind of thing, and the European Commission's been very specific about that. What happened in 2015 was Volkswagen deliberately designed a software system which would allow its cars to get through the quite stringent US emissions controls when being used on the road, still pumping out a great deal of pollution. That was a deliberate attempt to subvert emissions controls. What we're seeing here is an attempt to reduce competition between car makers, which would have had the effect of delaying the introduction of better emissions control technology. So it is a different thing.
Theo, just remind us of the tension between these auto manufacturers and environmental regulations. Would the lives of these companies be easier? Would they make more profit if they didn't have to follow these regulations? And is that behind the allegations of the EU?
Car makers are being forced by the European Union institutions to reduce their emissions. And every few years, the standards they're expected to adhere to are ramped up so they can produce less and less carbon dioxide, less and less nitrogen oxides. And that's forcing them to carry out research in other areas into zero emissions vehicles, for example. And this does cost money, there's no question. What the car makers are alleged to have done over the past few years is pulled out all the stops to delay new standards from coming in. So, hypothetically speaking, if you had a group of manufacturers who said it was not possible to introduce a given technology before a specific date, that might encourage the legislators to row back on the kind of standards they were supposed to be introducing. So they are accused, at the very least, of having done a lot to delay the introduction of strict emission standards. And it is hard for them to design cars to strict emission standards. They have to include all sorts of new systems like selective catalytic reduction systems, which are complicated, which add weight, which can have an effect on performance. So they don't want to do it unless they have to. But they are slowly being coerced by the legislators, and allegedly, they do all they can to delay that process.
Do we know how much these companies have seen profits drop as a result of stricter environmental regulations? And also VW specifically, how much has it been hit by its 2015 scandal?
Well, it's impossible to say how much company profits have been hit by having to introduce emission control systems. They have been introduced on a regular basis over a period of decades. What we can say is that Volkswagen itself paid a heavy penalty for the scandal that engulfed it in 2015. It's running at more than $30 billion so far, and that's in terms of clean air penalties, settlements with the Department of Justice, compensating consumers, buying back affected vehicles, and so on. But you have to say that in terms of its business, Volkswagen hasn't done at all badly. It's producing more cars now than it was before the scandal erupted, and it's still highly profitable.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, I mean, since Volkswagen has been here before, can they afford another scandal? But it sounds like they can't afford another scandal.
The worst factor, potentially, is what it would do to public opinion in its home market. Because in Germany, the population there is very sensitive about car makers being accused in any way, shape or form of gaming the system in terms of emissions. And the car makers there, and these are all German car makers that we're talking about, are facing a lot of political pressure to reduce the emissions produced by their cars in any case.
My BBC colleague, Theo Leggett, their business correspondent, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Still to come on the show, in Taiwan, testing for English as a foreign language has angered people taking the exam thanks to one word, China. We'll explain next here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. Thousands of students in Taiwan have joined a protest. The source of their frustration is the TOEFL exam. That's a test of English as a foreign language that many Taiwanese students need to take to get into college. The reason they're not happy about the test has nothing to do with the test questions themselves. It's about politics. I've got the BBC Cindy Su on the line from Taipei to tell us more. So what exactly are the students upset about, Cindy?
Last month, some of the students noticed that on the website of the nonprofit U.S. organization that administers the TOEFL test, it's called the Educational Testing Service, ETS.
Right.
On their website, they've changed the way they refer to Taiwan as Taiwan, China. Now, in the past, they simply refer to Taiwan on their drop-down menu of countries and locations. But somehow they changed the designation of Taiwan. And that has upset a lot of students here because they see Taiwan as a sovereign, independent country, not a part of China. So that prompted the students to write letters to ETS to protest and to demand that they change it back to Taiwan.
So this is kind of a matter of patriotism for these students?
Yes, and identity. It's actually an ongoing issue. It's a huge controversy. Sometime over the past year, China has finally had enough with companies, and including airlines, hotels, and even fashion labels referring to Taiwan as a country. So it sent out letters to a lot of companies, including like United Airlines, the Marriott Hotels, and Zara, a fashion brand, to demand that they change the way they refer to Taiwan on their websites or face consequences, for instance, having their websites being shut down in China. So a lot of the companies have complied or found a neutral way of dealing with this very controversial, divisive issue. And it seems like now China is going after not only companies, but even nonprofit organizations. And ETS is one of the ones that would directly be felt by young people on both sides, because if they want to study abroad, they have to prove their English proficiency through these tests.
I mean, the TOEFL test, as you say, administered by the Educational Testing Service, ETS, they are a massive organization. They run GRE and a lot of other standardized tests. What reason did ETS give for changing the name of Taiwan?
Well, ETS has been lying low. It hasn't, you know, given interviews to the media. I've seen reporting about this, and I've already emailed them, and they haven't written back to me. But, you know, if you look at the numbers, I mean, they have a lot more mainland Chinese students taking this test than Taiwanese students. About 30% of the international students studying in the U.S. are mainland Chinese students. You know, some 600,000 mainland Chinese students chose to study abroad last year, and only 60,000, one-tenth that figure, from Taiwan. So, you know, you could tell that they make a lot more money from the mainland Chinese students signing up for these tests.
And another thing, Cindy, just this week, China accused Taiwanese intelligence agencies of preying on Chinese students. It feels like something new is going on here. What is it?
Something dramatically different has happened in the past 2 years. You know, previously, we had the best relations between the two sides since the end of the Chinese Civil War in 1949. But since 2016, when the current Taiwanese president Tsai Ing-wen was elected, relations have been deteriorating ever since. And the reason for that is because President Tsai does not want to meet Beijing's demand that she agree to the so-called 1992 consensus, which under Beijing's definition defines Taiwan and mainland China as part of one China. Taiwan is part of the Chinese psyche, the identity of Chinese people, that they do not want to let go of this island. So it doesn't trust President Tsai's administration, basically. So it's finding all kinds of ways to make things difficult for her and as a result for Taiwanese people.
The BBC's Cindy Hsu speaking with us from Taipei. Thank you very much, Cindy.
Thank you.
One of China's biggest stars has disappeared without a trace. Actress Fan Bingbing is one of the country's most popular and highest paid actresses. You might recognize her as Blink in X-Men: Days of Future Past. She was last seen in public in early June when she posted a photo to her social media account when she visited a children's hospital in Tibet. The government in China has been quiet on the story, and no criminal charges have been brought against the actress. There's speculation that her absence is related to tax evasion matters. Ann Kokas is author of a book, Hollywood Made in China. So disappearing for tax evasion, I mean, is that one scenario? Is it a common occurrence in China's entertainment business?
Well, it's a very common occurrence in China, particularly with regard to government officials. And tax evasion is very common within the entertainment industry. Now, there was previously also a defamation case in which Fan criticized Guo Wengui, another major figure in China, for critiquing her affairs with Chinese officials.
So, Anne, what do you think is going on? Have you been tracking the story closely enough that you have a theory?
I think, first of all, there are probably a lot of things going on in this case, so I'm hesitant to give one definitive theory. However, I think that it is noteworthy that Fan Bingbing is the highest, one of the highest paid actresses in the world and the highest paid actress in China. And I think that this sends a very clear message to the Chinese entertainment industry that as it becomes bigger, as it becomes more globally prominent, as people are making more money, that they need to clean up their act in terms of how they handle their finances.
We know the story, of course, of Ai Weiwei, the Chinese artist who was detained for nearly 3 months. He was released after he signed a confession that Chinese authorities described as being related to tax evasion. So hard to know what that's really about. There was with Ai Weiwei, though, a huge international campaign to have him released. And obviously the Chinese government wasn't happy with that. But could there be the same kind of international publicity over Fan Bingbing?
Now, we could see something like that with Fan Bingbing. She is a very big international star. However, there's an important qualitative difference in terms of the role that Ai Weiwei and Fan Bingbing play in relation to the Chinese state. At the time that Ai Weiwei was being detained, he was already a known Chinese dissident and was well regarded internationally for his art that pushed back against the state. By contrast, Fan Bingbing has had a much lower profile with regard to any kind of political action. She's actually just most well known for her big paydays in action movies.
Also, I'm just curious to hear your take on this. Is there a harsher approach toward Chinese women celebrities? Is there a female double standard?
Absolutely. We have seen this time and time again in the case of Zhang Ziyi, most famous for her role in Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, another Ang Lee film.
Right.
She was accused of being a high-paid prostitute, and her career hasn't completely recovered from that.
So speaking of the privilege of celebrities and movies, there's another big talking point lately, the wealth of people we see in the blockbuster film Crazy Rich Asians.
The Nick you're dating is Nick Young?
Yeah, you guys know them or something?
Hells yeah. They're just the biggest developers in all of Singapore.
Damn, Rachel. It's like the Asian Bachelor.
These people aren't just rich, they're crazy rich.
Now you really should have told me that you're like Prince William of Asia.
That's ridiculous. Much more of a Harry.
So Chinese authorities have denounced the movie because of the depictions of wealthy Chinese, which is not the message China wants to put out. And I'm wondering if you see a connection between the disdain, if we can call it that, for wealth in China, also the quiet admiration for that wealth and what we see on display in that movie.
Well, I would say it's less of a problem with wealth and more a problem with consumer ostentatiousness. On one hand, it's great to be able to become internationally successful and to have, you know, manufacturing wealth or wealth in tech. But there's a very slippery slope. Once that wealth is seen as ostentatiousness, it can become a political problem for the people who have it.
Anne Kokas is the author of Hollywood Made in China. She's also an assistant professor of media studies at the University of Virginia. Anne, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you so much for having me, Marco.
You're with the world. I'm Marco Werman. Still ahead on the show, Bobby Wine was jailed and tortured for opposing authoritarian rule in Uganda. He flew to Massachusetts for medical attention, but also to thank his supporters for saving his life.
I must say that maybe I wouldn't be alive if you did not exert the pressure that you exerted.
That story still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. The Trump administration is reducing the number of refugees it's allowing into the country. When Donald Trump took office, the cap on refugees was 110,000. Trump quickly lowered that to 50,000, and on Monday, the administration said it was cutting the cap again, this time to 30,000 refugees. Supporters of a harder line on immigration will applaud the trend, but we wanted to ask an advocate for refugees. Nazanin Ash is with the International Rescue Committee. How has the IRC been dealing with this announcement, Nazanin?
So our first concern is for the millions of refugees desperately seeking safety who will not now find that refuge here in the United States. And I'd say our second reaction is tremendous disappointment at the direction the administration has taken. The refugee program itself has proven its success, with refugees proving to be a net benefit to our economy, and the security of the program demonstrated by the successful integration of 3 million refugees since 1980. There's nothing to indicate going lower, everything to indicate going higher.
How concerned are you about a race to the bottom where refugee acceptance numbers just dwindle all over the world?
I think that what this administration has misunderstood in the context of its burden sharing goals is that in the context of refugee resettlement, the U.S. is doing far less than its fair share, right? So you consider a country like Bangladesh with a population of 120 million, currently hosting nearly 1 million Rohingya, absorbing 700,000 Rohingya refugees in a matter of weeks with an economy that is, you know, a negligible fraction of what we have in the U.S., right? You consider Lebanon, where one in four residents is a refugee. You consider Jordan hosting refugees at a cost of almost 10% of its GDP. Uganda absorbing another million South Sudanese refugees just last year. So we are doing far less than our fair share. The other thing that the administration has misunderstood, they seem to think that the U.S. doing less will mean others will do more. We see precisely the opposite and can document it. Because, of course, those countries are saying, they've literally saying out loud, if wealthy nations won't, why should we?
How do you think this 30,000 cap will impact our long-term ability in this country to take in refugees in a post-Trump America? Can another administration just raise the number again to a different level?
You know, a reference point I often think of is what happened to refugee resettlement after 9/11. It's a devastating event for our country. It necessarily forces an entire top-to-bottom review of our security agencies. We created the Department of Homeland Security. We reviewed every path to admission to the United States. We introduced new vetting procedures, new bureaucracies. You know, it was a time of great reconfiguration. And two things happened. President Bush, to his credit, did not at all lower the refugee ceiling. He made a point of maintaining a commitment to, at the time, admitting 70,000 refugees. Nonetheless, as a function of creating the Department of Homeland Security and all of the bureaucratic changes and reconfigurations taking shape, the refugee, you know, we only managed to admit 27,000 refugees in that first year after 9/11, 28,000 in the year following, and then we were already back up to 54,000 3 years after 9/11. You know, the impact of, you know, several years of low refugee admissions will be long term. It'll take us years to rebuild from this, and we see the entirety of this program at risk.
Nazanin Ash with the International Rescue Committee speaking with us from Washington. Really appreciate your time. Thank you.
Thank you, Marco.
And on the same kind of topic, here's something I learned this week in my own backyard. Waltham, Massachusetts, a suburb of Boston, not too far from our studio. It's also known as Little Kampala. That's Kampala as in the capital of Uganda in East Africa. It gives you a sense of how many Ugandan expatriates and Ugandan Americans live there. A couple of nights ago, I spent some time with a group of them, at least 300 or so, in a hotel ballroom. And to a person, they were overwhelmingly opposed to the longtime ruler of Uganda, Yoweri Museveni.
We want a Uganda where a president comes and goes and we can change power without shedding blood. That's the Uganda that I know all of you are looking forward to.
The guest of honor this night really didn't need an introduction.
Welcoming Honorable Robert Chagulanyi.
Robert Chagulanyi is a politician, a musician, and an activist. He's better known as Bobby Wine. Bobby Wine is a popular singer in Uganda who put his music career on hold and ran for parliament on a platform of change. The 80-something President Museveni has been in power since 1985 and tolerates no dissent. Bobby Wine's political positioning landed him in detention, where he was tortured. The Ugandan government says he was only beaten, but his injuries were serious. That's why he came to Boston earlier this month to get medical attention. The mostly young crowd of Ugandans who came out to see him gave him quite the welcome.
Keep up power! Keep up power! Keep up power!
People power, our power. It's the slogan of Bobi Wine's movement. He doesn't have a lot of vocal support among Uganda's political old guard, but he says he has the support of the people. And because it's risky back home in Uganda to rally behind anyone who opposes the president, Bobi Wine wanted people in Boston to know that their support helped him get through his time in detention.
I must say that maybe I wouldn't be alive if you did not exert the pressure that you exerted. You guys may not know, but you actually saved my life. You enabled me to travel here, but you continue to save the lives of the people back home.
Ugandans know Bobi Wine as a musician activist first. His life as a politician advocating on behalf of change in Uganda, that's a new role, but he continues to find moments to sing. Bobi Wine was elected to Uganda's parliament in June of 2017. Since then, he's put out a couple of politically provocative songs, like this one.
What is the purpose of the Constitution when the government disrespects the Constitution? Where is my freedom of expression when you charge me because of my expression? Look what you're doing to this nation. What are you teaching the future generation? See our leaders become misleaders and see our mentors become tormentors. Freedom fighters become dictators. They look on the youth and say we are distractors. We are fighting for freedom. We are fighting for freedom.
After the rally in the hotel ballroom, I sat down to speak with Bobi Wine in his limo. Portable radio studio. Thank you so much for your time. Because of the beating he got in detention, Bobi Wine has a bad limp. He walks with a large wooden cane that's got animal motifs carved into it. He kept it by his side as we spoke. Can I ask you how your health is?
Well, my health is getting better. As you can see, I'm walking, although I still have pain in the back, a lot of pain. So I'm walking with a walking cane, but I have faith that I'll get better in a short while.
And what kind of medical attention have you needed, and what specific injuries? I mean, what happened to you in detention?
I got my back tissue very bruised, it's totally smashed, and I was injected with different things that I don't know. I've been getting treatment in Washington, and now I'm better.
What were they trying to do to you during the torture? Were they trying to extract some kind of confession or admission?
Well, they were not asking any particular questions. They probably just wanted to punish me for my outspokenness.
I mean, your driver recently, Yasin Kawuya, was killed by police in Uganda, and you believe it was a case of mistaken identity, and that the police fired at him thinking it was you.
Yeah.
Why do you think you're still alive?
I think I'm still alive because I'm lucky. I was sitting in the exact seat where Yasin was killed from by gunfire, but for some reason I got up because I was being delayed by the guys that were supposed to drive me, so I got into another car. And that is how Yasin Kawuma ended up in that seat and ended up dead.
Bobi Wine, what do you want for Uganda? What are you fighting for as a politician?
We're fighting for a well-governed Uganda where everybody is equal before and under the law, where the rule of law is what prevails, where citizens are the masters and the leaders are true servants of the people, where the natural resources of the country are equally shared, where there's equal opportunity for everybody, regardless of your tribe, sex, or religion. That is the Uganda we're fighting for.
Tell me a little bit about your support here in the United States, because you came here to the United States for medical treatment, and in your recovery, you went to Washington, you held a town hall meeting there, you appeared on Voice of America, and now you're leading this gathering here in Boston. Who are the Ugandans who are supporting you in the United States?
I must say, very many Ugandans. Very many of them I've never met before. But they stood up and made themselves counted. They stood with us, and they continue standing with us. And even non-Ugandans, but those who feel concerned with the plight of Ugandans have equally raised their voices. So this has gone beyond a Ugandan issue. It is a humanity issue.
I want to just read you something that your attorney, Robert Amsterdam, said. We had him on our show not long ago. He said, Americans need to know that their war on terror has empowered Museveni with hundreds of millions of dollars of armaments, which he is using to torture his own people. And I think it's a massive lesson for American taxpayers. We really need to reassess what the war on terror is doing when all of these monies and armaments are being given to despots to torture their own people. Do you agree with Robert Amsterdam's assessment? And what do you think Uganda would look like if Museveni was not getting support from the United States?
I agree with Robert Amsterdam. I believe that Museveni, under the disguise of fighting terror, has been able to blind the eyes of not only the United States government, but indeed most of the development partners. Uganda enjoys the relationship with the United States and indeed with all development partners and would like to have it go on. But it is my opinion, and indeed the opinion of many Ugandans, that the development partners deal with Uganda as a nation and not with Museveni, deal with institutions and not with individuals, because sooner or later there will be no more Museveni. Does that mean the United States will stop dealing with Uganda? No. Uganda holds our relationships with our development partners strongly, and we want to continue those relationships. So we do not want the relationship to be between the United States and a person and an individual, but United States and the Uganda government as an institution.
You're married, are you not, sir?
Yes, I am married.
How is your wife dealing with this whole situation?
Many times my wife is frightened. My family has seen what has happened to all the freedom fighters, so they're always expecting the worst.
What do you tell her to keep her on the up?
I always tell her to be strong. I always tell her that one day things must get better.
When will you be returning to Uganda, and what precautions are you taking for your safety?
I'll be landing in Uganda this Thursday. And to be honest, the only precaution I take for my safety is speaking out, because I know back in Uganda, many people, even those who don't speak out, have suffered the brunt of misgovernance. So I will continue standing for the truth, even when it means paying a price for it.
Bobby Wan, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it.
You're most welcome. Thank you for having me.
Since independence in 1962, Uganda has been through a turbulent history. The notorious times of Milton Obote and Idi Amin have been joined now in infamy by the 32-year rule of Yoweri Museveni. Bobby Wine says his movement is not about him. He says he's enabling the people to be powerful. But there's no doubt that Bobby Wine is the man of the moment at the center of a new chapter in Uganda. He seems to know that he might not live to see the end of Museveni's rule, but he and his supporters also seem pretty certain that Museveni's time is quickly running out. Corruption is a part of everyday life in Guatemala. Few Guatemalans are surprised when they hear stories about politicians using public funds for lavish vacations or shopping abroad. But that's been changing in recent years. With help from the United Nations, Guatemala created an anti-corruption commission. It led to some 300 convictions and put two former presidents behind bars. These days, though, Guatemala's president, Jimmy Morales, thinks the crusade against corruption has gone too far. This week, Morales prevented the head of the Anti-Corruption Commission from re-entering the country. That has activists like Gabriel Weir outraged. He's the head of a citizens group called Justicia Ya, or Justice Now, in Guatemala City. Weir says President Morales wants to stymie the commission because it's investigating him.
It was revealed after an investigation from the commission that during his campaign, he was mostly funded from illegal sources. And he doesn't want to respond to this. He's trying to shut down the investigation.
So intellectually, President Morales supported the commission. But when they got too efficient and found he might be corrupt, he started pulling his support.
Yes. And he not only was he involved, but also his son and his brother are involved in another case of corruption. And we know now that he's going to try to dissolve the commission unilaterally without asking the UN. And in the agreement that was signed almost 10 years ago, it was designed in a way to avoid this sort of thing, that if a government that was being investigated wanted to dissolve the commission, that it would be illegal. And he's doing that. And our highest court, the Constitutional Court, has now ruled that it is illegal to do what he's trying to do. So we're in the brink of really a coup that he's doing to disobey the Constitutional Court, which is really, really, really something that no one here in Guatemala wants.
Yeah, you said you see kind of a constitutional coup d'etat in all of this?
Yeah, exactly.
So what can civil society groups like yours do about this?
We've been mobilizing for the past 2 or 3 weeks in every part of the country. Even groups of Guatemalans that live in the United States are mobilizing in the embassy there and in the UN, just trying to get our voice heard that we don't want the commission to be dissolved. We want the commission to continue, and that all this that is happening is just because we have a sitting president that doesn't want to face justice.
So the president wants to get rid of the UN Anti-Graft Commission. What is the way forward?
We see a lot of other countries supporting. For example, the European Union has been very clear about that. Canada has also been very clear about its support towards the commission. And also the UN, the Secretary General, Antonio Guterres, has been also very, very clear about the support. And for us here in Guatemala, it's about voicing our concerns. And that's why, for example, last week we had almost every day there was some sort of demonstration around the country. And we're going to see bigger demonstrations this week as well.
So we were under the impression that military tanks had actually encircled the commission's headquarters. Can you tell us what you saw?
Yes, I saw them. They're not there anymore. But the day that President Morales announced that the commission's agreement would not be renewed, he was standing with military officials in the press conference. At the same time, we saw military vehicles around the commission and also around the U.S. embassy, which was very surprising because these vehicles were donated by the United States to fight drug dealers and drug cartels in the borders. So it was really surprising to see them here in Guatemala City. They should be in the borders, safeguarding the borders against drug cartels. So that was something that really shocked people. That's also with what's happening in Nicaragua, with what's happening in Venezuela. We're really worried to see what Morales is capable of.
Gabriel Huer is an anti-corruption activist in Guatemala. He's the head of Justicia Ya, or Justice Now. Speaking with us from Guatemala City. Thank you very much, Gabriel.
Thank you.
Before we let you go, we wanted to spend a few minutes talking about grooming standards. And thank goodness I'm in character. I actually shaved this morning, a routine I dislike. If I were a pilot, Air Canada would have had a problem with me. But it announced this week it's allowing its air crew to grow beards. Think about it. Have you ever seen a pilot with a beard? Have you ever wondered why? It turns out it's all about safety, supposedly. The World's Chris Wolf has been unmasking the story. Sorry about that, Chris. What is the deal here?
Well, in the event of emergency, Marco, you want to be sure that your pilot gets enough oxygen from his safety mask, right?
Yeah.
Well, it's always been assumed a beard would stop you getting all the oxygen you need from that mask that drops down, you know, from the ceiling, or that smoke might be able to sneak in if there's not a perfect seal. So that's bad luck for Joe Harry Passenger, but the pilot never got a choice until now.
Yeah, so why this change from Air Canada? They decided that you can breathe through your beard?
Well, yeah, new research has shown that this fear is not supported by science. Air Canada actually commissioned a very thorough study by the Simon Fraser University in British Columbia, SFU, and men with all kinds of beards, from stubble to waist-length beards, were pulled into a hyperbaric chamber, which is one of those, you know, things they have in labs that can simulate.
You're serious.
Absolutely. Major changes in air pressure and drop in oxygen supply and that kind of thing. And the study found that in 100% of the cases, even the guy with the waist-length beard, it had no impact. The beard had no impact on the levels of oxygen saturation or a smoke inhalation. By the way, Air Canada commissioned the study after a request from a Sikh pilot. As you know, Sikhs, or Sikhs as they're sometimes called here, are required by their religion to wear beards, and this guy wanted to fly.
Incredible. So this all prompted an interesting comment from you at this morning's show meeting. What'd you say?
Well, I said it reminds me of my time in the army. They always told us the same thing. You have to be clean shaven to ensure a tight fit for the gas mask.
And also false, presumably, now? Or, I mean, chemicals could get in through that mask, I'm thinking.
Well, Simon Fraser University is going to find out. Apparently, they've been approached by the Canadian Armed Forces to carry out a study for them in regard to nuclear, biological and chemical threats as well. Of course, us grunts were and are, I think, skeptical of everything we're told. And we were pretty sure that the higher-ups just wanted us to... One just wanted to use it as an excuse to make us look neat and tidy, you know, because a cold shave in the woods is never fun, you know, and we prefer to look a little bit more gnarly, you know.
So what's the deal right now in the Canada and U.S. With their militaries with beards and other facial hair?
Basically, it's a no-go unless you have a religious or medical exemption. And that's been the case pretty much since the advent of chemical weapons in World War One. You think back in time to the flamboyant beards and goatees of the American Civil War era and the mutton chop whiskers. That all went out the window with the coming of chemical weapons and the terror of gas and the need for gas masks. There are exceptions, of course, for some traditional roles like army pioneers in Canada or submariners on patrol in the U.S. Navy, if their captain approves, can just let their beards grow out of tradition. And U.S. Special Forces have also had a pass since 2010. So officially, the uniform personal appearance and grooming is believed to contribute to discipline and camaraderie and hygiene, although I'd love to see the science on that, too.
The World's History Guy, Chris Wolf, thank you.
You're welcome, Marco.
At the bottom of the show, taking a little bit off the top. That'll do it for us. From the Nan and Bill Harris Studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. Back with you tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.